This is Growth Minded Milwaukee, powered by WTMJ Mobile.
Hey everybody, this is Todd McLeese welcoming you back to Growth Minded Milwaukee, powered by the WTMJ Mobile platform. Our show focuses on entrepreneurs, business leaders, and their collaborations that serve as catalysts for the new economy in Wisconsin and the surrounding region. This one's a really special episode as we welcome George Mosier into the Growth Minded studio. For those of you that are unfamiliar with George, he first made a name for himself by founding National Business Furniture here in Milwaukee with his wife, Julie. And they grew that company until a very successful exit about 10 years ago. What separates George from other business owners was the path he went down following the sale of his company. Rather than seek warmer climates, George has established himself as a titan in Milwaukee's early stage community. Since his sale of National Business Furniture, George has invested in over 100 early stage ventures and seemingly has no plans to slow down. George is a fountain of knowledge when it comes to entrepreneurship and early stage investments here in Milwaukee, and he shares the valuable insights and lessons he learned along the way during the show. I hope you enjoyed the episode as much as we enjoyed the time we had with George. I want to say thanks for listening to the show. So without further ado, here is George Mosier. So we're here on the Growth Minded Podcast, joined by George Mosier. George, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Okay, you're welcome, Todd.
What brought you to Milwaukee?
Well, I had been active as a sort of in a small style entrepreneur while I was going to school. My first father died in the war, and he died in a German prisoner of war camp from starvation. And shortly thereafter, my mother got remarried. They married really for economic reasons. They fell in love after they got married. And my second father liked to take sandwiches to work. And I basically didn't like sandwiches. I liked hot food. So I thought if I'm going to eat well, I need to have some of my own money. So that acted as a strong entrepreneurial drive. And I was encouraged early on to work as a caddy in golf for a year or two, and then I worked in an amusement park for a year. And then I drove an ice cream truck for 3 years. And in the final year of driving the ice cream truck, which was owned by Harvard Student Agencies, I was able to earn $2,000 at a time when tuition at Harvard was $1,650. So that got me interested in making money and having my own money, and now I could do things that I otherwise couldn't have afforded. And I also got active at the Harvard Yearbook selling advertising. And at Harvard Business School, I was asked to be advertising manager of the Harbus. And they, for the first time, they put it on a profitable basis as opposed to just being supported by the student agency. And in the first issue that came out, I went away for the summer. I hired some people to sell advertising for it. And the first issue was 16 pages. And I had a headmate, which means we shared the same bathroom, at Harvard Business School. His name was Dick Resch, and he had come originally from Minneapolis and wanted to get back to the Midwest. Hmm. And so he gave me a call, and he said, George, how would you like to take over a mail-order catalog company in Milwaukee? And my image of Milwaukee was somewhere between Newark and Bridgeport. But I was ready. I was working for Look Magazine and caught a little bit up in the bureaucracy. And so I decided I would take that job. So we came out here, and that was 1965. And the company had been in business for 3 years and had never had a profitable month. And I realized that the sales of $250,000 were not enough. And I figured out that we could mail more catalogs, and we got the sales up to about $750,000 in the first year.
In the first year.
So, and it was marginally profitable, which was a big change from before. Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, you were instrumental in growing that catalog company nationally. So what prompted your decision to leave?
And the people involved decided that I was going to start to make too much money. I was had a contract that said I would earn 10% of the profits. And they thought that was going to be too much money. So they were trying to rejigger the contract.
That's the impetus behind National Business Furniture,
right,
that you and your wife started in 1975?
1975. They knew that I was a compromiser, but my wife has got a strong inner strength also. And there was no way that she was going to compromise. So in 7 weeks, in 20 minutes, I walked into the Heritage Bank, and I had the money from Roger Dirksen based on the value of my house. Mm-hmm. And it was a great benefit of inflation because the house had gone in value from $30,000 to $100,000. So I was able to borrow $50,000 to start the company. And in 7 weeks, we had our own catalog, and we changed the catalog from an emphasis on church and school furniture to an emphasis on office furniture. And so we were not directly competitive with the previous company. Mm-hmm. But right from the beginning, we got very strong results, and we never really had a losing period.
Can you help us understand a little bit more about that revenue trajectory and maybe some of the key ingredients that led to that growth?
Well, first of all, it took us about 3 years to get to $3 million in revenue. And thereafter, it doubled every 5 years, which is a growth rate of 15%. And there were some ups and downs with the economy, but on the whole, it was pretty steady. As I look back on it, it went from 3 to 6 to 12 to 24 to 48. And it was at a time when your employees also expected a 15% growth, so they didn't feel the company was growing fast enough. So there was both internal and pressure from myself and external pressure from employees to grow and provide opportunities for growth.
Mm-hmm. George, you're such a fixture in Milwaukee and really throughout the state and its early stage community, and you have shared a lot of lessons and insights with the entrepreneurs that you've interacted with. Which of those did you learn directly from your time growing National Business Furniture?
Well, National Business Furniture, I focused on keeping it simple. Every 4 months, we would formally sit down and list all of the different ways we could grow and then evaluate which of those seemed to make sense. And what we gradually found is there was always some small ideas you could do this or that. When we went through the formal process of saying how could we grow, by listing the pros and cons of each, it became clear that a lot of the small ideas would yield small results. But we were also very efficient. One of the most important courses I had in business school was a course in production. And I realized that running an office can be treated like running a factory, but you can't call it a factory. But every process needs to be standardized. My goal was to get $1 million in sales per employee, which we ultimately achieved. But we ran the whole company with a payroll cost of 4%, including my own. And the net effect is that our competition could not keep up with us.
Obviously, today we see fewer and fewer catalogs circulating around as the internet has taken over. What did you do at National Business to transition and keep up with that shift in the market?
We had looked at the internet coming along, and I had concluded that just like catalogs, furniture was not going to be the first thing that you bought on the internet, that you needed to buy something like a book, or women started to buy clothing. Mm-hmm. And then there was a year that Land's End all of a sudden got a tremendous amount of catalog business or internet business. And their typical shopper for Christmas was a male who had decided he could pick small, medium, and large and select between pink, blue, and green. And he went to the internet, landsend.com, like he might have called 800 information for Land's End before. So at that point, we made an all-out push to learn more about how the internet would work. And in the process of that, there was a company called OfficeFurniture.com, which was part of the office or the internet boom. They had never made any money, but if you hit Office Furniture on Google, that's what came up. Mm-hmm. And they had built a selection of products. They were drop shipping from the factory just like we were. Mm-hmm. And originally, I was not interested because I would not spend $10 million on anything. But then it became clear they were going to go out of business. We probably spent more than we had to. Then the next thing we did is we said if their furniture was primarily aimed at the home market. Mm-hmm. So on the website, we essentially said, if you're looking for home office furniture, go to this part of the site. If you're looking for full-fledged office furniture, go to this part of the site. And we were able to take the National Business Furniture Catalog and put that on the web. So that became the catalyst for doing that.
You've described a few other acquisitions with National Business Furniture that were salient to the growth of the business. What did you find to be particularly difficult when it came to bringing new employees into the fold via acquisition?
Well, what we learned with officefurniture.com and a couple of other companies is that individual employees can be great, but if you've been working for a company that's been losing money, they come with the attitude that this is hard and they're discouraged. They don't have the self-esteem that comes from being part of a successful team. I think one of the things that's never talked about is that the average person, really what they want is to be part of a successful team. They don't necessarily want to run things, but it's why we root for the Brewers and the Packers. Even though none of the Packers live in Wisconsin, this is our team, and the amount of loyalty and enthusiasm they were able to build is strong.
I know one lesson I've heard you share previously is to surround yourself with people who have different strengths and weaknesses than your own. Can you think of any examples from early on that helped to instill that mindset within you?
Well, first of all, my partner was my wife. She had opposite strengths than I have. I'm an optimist. She tended to be a pessimist. The truth is somewhere in between. She has a right brain, a creative brain. I have a left brain, a numerical brain. We built a catalog on the theme of beautiful offices at affordable prices, and she had a way of designing the catalog so it made it look like this is furniture you'd feel comfortable having in your office. And that was very instrumental.
As I was getting ready for today's conversation, I was reading whatever I could, and one of the articles I came across had to do with the scorecard you were keeping at the seven-year mark. You'd made 152 investments, 35 losses, and 17 wins. What does the scorecard look like today?
Well, it's now up to 243, and I've had about 30 wins and about 70 losses, so the proportions are staying the same. And there's another 140 that are in various stages of life, some of which are very marginally alive and some of which are thriving and will be successful.
Mm-hmm. 243 investments in a 10-year period is a lot, probably even by most VC standards. Can we talk a little bit more about that? What motivates you to stay so involved in early stage?
Well, if we go back to the beginning, the impetus for this is I had done some angel investing while I was still running National Business Furniture. Mm-hmm. And on the whole, it had been interesting and reasonably successful. So when it came time to sell the company, I wasn't ready to retire yet. And part of it was substitution for philanthropy. I said to myself, I've got some money, I've got some skills, there are young people out there that have ideas and energy and talent. And if I can help them, what they don't have is money. And if I can help them get started, they can build a business.
It seems that as involved as you are, you can't help but continue to learn every day too. Is that part of the passion that drives you every day to be so involved in so many different?
Well, I will share a little story that I don't tell very often. I was in New York and I got involved in a weekly poker game. And I'd been winning a little bit, and then I started to lose a little bit. So I decided that I would needed to know more about poker. So I went out and bought 4 books on how to play poker. And in 7 weeks, this was a game where people were winning $30 and losing 20, more losers than winners. And all of a sudden, in 7 weeks, I'd won $250. So that showed me the value of an education. If you focus in on a subject, you can learn a lot. At that point, the phone rang and someone said, how would you like to move to Milwaukee? So the game would not have been able to take somebody winning that consistently. So I've been a big believer. What I learned at Harvard Business School, I've been able to use for the next 50 years. And the basic principles don't change. The tools keep changing, but the principles don't change. And I like keeping up with things. I'm curious, and I enjoy everybody's story, and I enjoy working with people. Some of the things that I've been learning is all of our children, and by our, I mean the top 10% of the income stream, have had everything that they needed and most of what they wanted, and they did not grow up like people in my age with the concept of limited resources. And what I'm seeing is too many young people starting out, spending all their effort trying to raise money, as opposed to finding customers. So I'm now saying I really am limiting my investments to companies that have gotten at least $200,000 revenue. It's not a lot of revenue, but at least they found some customers, people who can use the product beyond their brother-in-law. Right. And we're so getting over that hump has been much more challenging.
Aside from all of your active investments and managing the portfolio, what else are you involving yourself in? Do you have any passion projects that are going on right now?
I'm starting to get interested in the whole concept of whether everyone should go to college, and we need more emphasis on how do you, if you work with your hands. I'm getting involved with an organization called Build to Learn, which construction workers are making $50,000. If you basically stay at something, you get to be good at it. And I think there's been too much emphasis on everybody should go to college. If you show up for work every day, one of the things that we found at National Business Furniture is you hire a typical, ordinary, reasonably well-motivated person. If they stay with you for 10, 20, 30 years, they become fantastic at the job that they're doing. They get to be experts at that, and that's what you want. And whether it's a file clerk or whether it's a customer service representative or a telephone salesperson, they just become great at the job. And we need more respect that any job is worth doing if someone's willing to pay for it. But it's important for you to make sure that you show up every day and do your – some days you'll feel better than others, but do your best every day and you will be far more valuable than the people, I'm not sure whether I should be here or not. Mm-hmm. And so I'm starting to pay attention to how you get people to get satisfied and want to do the things they really feel like doing.
That's really interesting. So does that coincide at all with the way education is evolving as well in terms of the online availability, I suppose at this moment, for-profit universities and edX and just platforms like that?
Well, I think what's happened is they've gotten a bad rap. If you talk to Henry Herzing, which runs Herzing's Institute, many people leave school, but they have no skill that's going to have a major effect on them. If they get concentrated and learn, my father actually taught for Career Academy after he retired. Mm. He was teaching designing and drafting, and he would get kids that really didn't know what they were going to do with their life. He happened to be an outstanding teacher, so he was able to take them, give them the skills that were necessary to get a job, and once they got the job with the right motivation, then they would keep it or they would build their skills. You're seeing a lot of that, I think, with the computer today. Kids who would formerly have been fixing their cars, it's almost impossible to do today, but they understand the computers, they get into the computers, and they can make the computer sing. And if they recognize that talent, these computers are always going to be changing, and if they can keep up with it. So the kind of for-profit school that really got you designed to do something needs to be more encouraged. Nonprofit is not low cost. Nonprofit is confused with being low cost, but without the incentive to make a profit, people aren't motivated properly to get something done.
Yeah. Another quote of your own talked about getting older and in retirement, wanting to stay involved and staying active and so forth. Can you just talk about what you see over the next few years for yourself in terms of level of involvement?
Well, first of all, I have to face the fact that a lot of it depends upon what my energy level is. When I sold the company, I knew that my number one responsibility was my wife and making sure that she was taken care of and everything was going okay. This has resulted in she needs warm weather, so we go to Florida and California for January, February, March. So I made up my mind I wasn't going to be totally invested in something that I had to be there. I always have lunch with somebody interesting every day, so I build my schedule around lunch.
Unfortunately, Milwaukee and the region around us has taken some heat for lack of innovation and dedication to the early stage community. Obviously, you're a key player in the community. So what's your take on that?
My take is there's a cultural difference between really the fact that I grew up in Boston was relevant to having some sense of entrepreneurial activity. It wasn't my family, but my best friend's family was the head of a major advertising agency. And in visiting with him, I would overhear conversations about various entrepreneurial activities. It was definitely part of the Boston culture. Interestingly, the Boston culture was based on academia, and it was sort of cheating to be working as a team originally. The California culture was based on teamwork, and as the computer got so complicated, it took five people to sit around and figure out how are we going to make this thing work. Mm-hmm. And in Milwaukee, there was a sense of safety. If you own a company in Milwaukee and it's successful, you have a good income, you have status, you have a certain amount of freedom, life really can't get any better than that. If you sell it for money, you have more money, but what are you really going to do? Mm-hmm. But in California, you don't have the status if you own a $10 or $20 million company. You're still second tier. You're not. It's almost like a movie star. Do you get invited to the A parties or do you get invited to the B parties? Mm-hmm. So if you sell your company and you have a successful exit, then you now, well, first of all, you can afford the house you really want to live in because a simple house in a good area is a seven-figure purchase. And in Milwaukee, you can live on what you can earn comfortably.
George, I really enjoyed the time together. Thanks so much for coming in the studio today. Thanks for listening to the conversation with George Mosier. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. George is an unbelievable story in Milwaukee. And given the knowledge and experience that he's willing to share, I think it's our job to pull as many lessons as we can from people like that. If you want to learn even more about George, find his episode on our Growth Minded Milwaukee YouTube page or on LinkedIn. We go even deeper into George's entrepreneurial background, his current investments, and his take on the Milwaukee region. Growth Minded Milwaukee is available on the WTMJ mobile platform, iTunes, and YouTube. Subscribe to the show so you don't miss out on future episodes and announcements. You can also find show notes for my conversation with George on our LinkedIn page. Until next time, thanks for joining us. Take care.